Welcome to The Gathering Resources. The following audio is from our breakout session entitled, How to Build Undivided and Reconciling Communities. This session is moderated by Michelle Dudley and features Chuck Mingo, David Bailey, and Vivian Long.
So thanks again. Thanks so much for coming out. Welcome to our discussion today on racial reconciliation. I'm so excited about the panel of experts that we have here with us. My name is Michelle Dudley, and in 2008, I was in Rwanda and really got open my eyes to the horrors of injustice. And after that, I just kind of began a journey of learning about injustice in kind of all of its forms, including racism. And in the last, during the last year, I co-facilitated two Be the Bridge groups in my hometown of Charlotte, North Carolina, and it was incredibly transformative for me. I heard about the lived experiences of predominantly African Americans in the Charlotte community at Friends, and the things that they were, the hardships that they were experiencing every day, and it really just opened my eyes even further. I feel like it's a journey, and that I've been on a journey of learning about really a lot about myself and my own white identity, and then the lived experiences of people who look different than me and are perceived different from me in our community. And that, this learning that I've been on, this journey that I've been on, caused me to take a look at my giving. It caused me to analyze my giving from a perspective of racial equity and who is leading the organizations that I'm funding, particularly in relation to the issues that are being funded. And so that's something that I've really taken a hard look at and tried to really pay attention to, because especially I led a ministry myself and have seen how it's harder for myself even as a woman to raise funds, and then knowing that it's that much harder for people of color to be able to raise funds for their work, but oftentimes they're the ones who are really need to have such an important voice into how the work is done and to leading the work. So anyway, I'm excited about my panel today. You can read detailed bios in the app about everyone, but we're gonna start with Chuck Mingo. Chuck is the founder of Undivided, and he's a teaching pastor at a large church in Cincinnati, Ohio, and he is passionate about educating leaders on racial issues. So, Chuck.
Thank you, Michelle. Yeah, happy to be here and happy to be with this amazing panel. So I'll just talk a little bit about our mission. The name of the organization is Courageous Love, and Living Undivided is one of our experiences. I'll talk a bit about that. But our mission is to unite and ignite people for racial justice. That's what we care about. And our primary audience for that is the church. It's the American church. And I'll talk a little bit about why as I go along, but let me just give you a little context on how we got started. So as Michelle said, I am on a teaching team at Crossroads Church, a large multi-site church in the Cincinnati area, Lexington area as well. And you know, like many churches, as things were happening amidst the country, increase in officer-involved shootings of unarmed African Americans, a lot of the stories that were coming out, Trayvon Martin, those kinds of things, we found ourselves in a place where we started to see kind of the fabric of our church and the differences in how people viewed those points of view. And we did a journey, a six-week experience in our church called Brave, and it was all around how Jesus invited Peter to walk on water. And the challenge everyone was gonna be facing is, what's the call? What is God calling you to do that feels like a brave next step? Mm-hmm. And for me, what I heard very clearly was to be a voice for racial healing, solidarity, and justice, and to do that in the context of our church. Little did I know that just a couple of months later, you know, you have those days that are just etched in your mind. One of them for me is July 29th, 2015. Because on July 29th, 2015, body cam footage became public of a local University of Cincinnati police officer who, at a routine traffic stop, a man who was pulled over for not having a front license plate, the man was murdered in that interaction. And that was like 5 miles from our church. And so what was happening out there in the country started to be something we were facing as a community. And as we walked through that, we learned a lot of things about the divided perspective, and we realized that something needed to be done. And so I kind of had an incredible team of people around me, and over the next 9 months, we created what is now Living Undivided. And what it is the six-week experience where we get people into mixed race groups, and it's facilitated. One of the facilitators is white, one of the facilitators is a black, indigenous, or person of color. And in these conversations, we share story. We talk about, when was your first experience with race, where you first were aware of it, yours or someone else's, because everyone has a story around that. We dive into history and we talk about it. One of my co-founders, Troy Jackson, was a pastor for 22 years, went back to the University of Kentucky, got a PhD in civil rights history. He's actually one of the editors of the King Papers. And so we deep dive into history and we do it in a way that makes it personal. And then people get to engage in their groups around that. We talk about systems and structures and how do we get to the systemic inequity that we experience. But our big heart in Living Undivided is to get people activated. So we don't want people to just go on a journey for 6 weeks. We want them to engage and be the hands and feet of Jesus in the work of racial solidarity, healing, and justice in their community. I'll give you just a context for Crossroads, how that's looked at our church is inviting people to do WizKids tutoring and mentoring, which is an incredible mentoring program in our city. We've had a lot of people who have done prison ministry, whether that's engaging in Bible studies, marriage ministry for inmates and their spouses, whether their spouses are equally incarcerated or not. We've had some incredible opportunities even to do Living Undivided in that space. But one of the big things that we did was we also said we want to change things at a systems level when we can. And so our church, people who did Undivided, were part of a 40 coalition of congregations in the Cincinnati area who in 2016 passed something called the Preschool Promise. And Preschool Promise was a tax levy, and it actually created $15 million that's still happening every year to provide quality preschool education for kids in our city who wouldn't otherwise get it. And it was that work that really got the attention of Dr. Hari Hahn. And Dr. Hari Hahn is, through Johns Hopkins University, the first director of the SNF Agora Institute. And she got excited about our work and wanted to measure our impact. And one of the things that she did is she started to do pre and post and understand what's happening on this journey. And we've learned over 7,500 people who've had this experience that Undivided has the ability to help people increase perspective taking for people who have a different point of view than they do. And it moves people from a place of isolation to belonging. I think a lot of us, as we think about how we might have felt in 2020, you might have felt like you were alone in your thoughts, or where do I go and process this? Undivided becomes a place where people can do that. And then also it moves people from passivity to action. And so again, for us, the desire is to get people engaged and to get them moving. And one of the things that I go back to in terms of that is I really believe the church needs to be at the forefront of this. So one of the great things that's happened through Undivided happened in 2020. Ahmed Beakley is a black man that goes to our church, lives in a suburb of Cincinnati. And after the murder of George Floyd, he felt this prompting from God. He had done Undivided, and he really felt this prompting from God to have lunch with his local police chief, Mike Mills. And so he did that. And at that lunch, they talked about, you know, how do we make sure this doesn't happen in our community? And coming out of that, Ahmed said, well, I did this thing called Undivided. And he talked a little bit about what it was. And Chief Mills was like, well, you know what? We're doing a lot of things in this area. We're not doing anything in that area. What if we do that? And so earlier this year, I got to facilitate over Zoom an incredible experience where half of the Zoom call were white male police officers from a Cincinnati suburb. The other half of the call were black and brown citizens from that community. And as you can imagine, you could cut the tension with a knife on night one in the midst of all that was going on in our country. But to see the six-week journey and to see them engage relationally, to engage in activities that are now continuing to impact their community was just a reminder to me that the church should be in this conversation. And the church can, in fact, lead this conversation. So when we think about our work, our vision is that there is a flow. I really believe this. I think about in Ezekiel where it talks about the flow of fresh water that was coming from God's temple, and it was flowing down to the Dead Sea. And literally, dead things were coming to life. And I believe when the church gets involved in this, dead things come to life. Things that feel like they can't come together, come together. And we're starting to see that, and it's just a really exciting time to be doing this. So I always encourage people, I know we're gonna go to some Q&A after you hear what my other amazing panelists are doing, but I always encourage people in the church, it's easy to think in this difficult time, why are we the ones that have to face such a difficult, polarized time, especially when it comes to race? But I wanna reframe that for you. I wanna encourage you that we don't have to do this. We get to do this. And that's a powerful shift in motivation and one of the reasons why I love being a part of the team and love being a part of the work that we're doing. And so as we're taking this across the nation, that's our heart, is that we get to do this. We get to be the body of Christ. And I do think this is a modern day apologetic. And how the church responds in this moment to the issue of racial division has a lot to say about the Savior that we love and serve. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Chuck. David Bailey is the founder of Erebon, which is based in Richmond, Virginia, and focuses on creating reconciling communities. And I've had the joy of participating in one of their programs, and I'm excited for David to be able to share.
That's Good. Well, thanks for having me. And I also want to say congratulations, because I was like, man, y'all must be really committed to have a conversation about race and make it all the way down here. So thank you so much. You know, I love to read this quote from a cultural critic that speaking to our time. It says, "But the judgment of God is upon the church as never before. If today's church does not recapture the sacrificial spirit of the early church, it will lose its authenticity, forfeit the loyalty of millions, and be dismissed as an irrelevant social club with no meaning for the 20th century. Every day, I meet young people whose disappointment with the church has turned into outright disgust." Just by show of hands, has anybody seen this? Have you witnessed this before? Let me ask you a question. Anybody have an idea who said it? Any guesses? If you're from Atlanta, you probably can't guess. It was actually Dr. Martin Luther King in his 1963 letter from a Birmingham jail. Now, you could have thought this was something that was actually said and quoted last week. But this is a really significant thing. And so it's really, like my brother Chuck said, is that, you know, this is one of the greatest apologetics of today. Now, here's the thing. The Beatles didn't create rebellious teenagers. They just created an opportunity for teenagers to express what they wanted to do. Now, here's the thing. Black Lives Matter didn't create the scenario, but there was a discontent that was going on that they created an opportunity for people to channel their energy. And my question is, why didn't the church create the opportunity to express the latent issues that were going on with race? And that's a very, very important question for us to ask. You know, one of the worst things you could do when it comes to like discipling young people, particularly like on issues of sex, is either do two things. One, it's either not talk about it at all, or two, when you do talk about it, the only way you talk about it is from a negative perspective. What I don't want you to do. If you don't talk about it at all, then somebody's going to disciple them in their worldview of how to engage with sex. Well, this is also the case when it comes to race. We either don't talk about it, or we talk about what we don't like. And so this is something that is a very, very significant spiritual formation issue that we have to engage. And this even goes to something deeper that's a fundamental foundation in our work at Erebon, is that we see the practice of reconciliation as spiritual formation. Mm-hmm. You know, I see some of y'all look like you've been married, you know, a few years. You know, I'm not gonna say how long, but you know, look like some of y'all been married a little time. And one of the first questions I ask before I marry anybody, do premarital counseling, I say, hey, have y'all had a fight before? And if they say no, then I say, you know, y'all aren't ready to get married. like the Beatles lied to us, like, you know, you need more than love. You need conflict resolution skills to be married longer than a year, right? And so, but when you look at this, when you engage in the practice of reconciliation, that actually enriches your relationship, your understanding of yourself, your understanding of the other. And you grow, and that's really key to spiritual formation and spiritual maturity. Well, one of the biggest problems that we've had, in particular in American church, is that we've designed most of our churches for it to be easy for everybody. That if we deal with conflict, then that must be the devil. And we need to make some adjustment, get rid of the thing, get rid of the tension, make everything as easy as possible. And we actually don't give people fundamental conflict resolution skills. So then when you add on something as long as race, a problem that was hundreds of years in the making, and we're only decades away from not saying like repenting, just changing the laws. We changed the laws like 50 years ago. And so it wasn't like an exorcism, it wasn't a time of like repenting or anything of that nature. We just changed the laws and kind of said, hey, let's try to do better. So then when you get another generation is like, hey, everything isn't right. You either have folks say, it's all bad, let's burn it all down, or you have folks that say, there's nothing going on here, it's totally fine, we just got to stop talking about it. And that's not aligned with the Bible. So what we do as a ministry at Erebon is that we help cultivate reconciling communities, give these five particular skills. One, laying a foundation as reconciliation and spiritual formation. And just do some basic Christian stuff. We don't make you be more conservative or more liberal. We just say, if you are conservative and you're a Christian conservative or you're liberal Christian or a progressive Christian, we're not, we just need to say, hey, that word Christian needs to mean something different than those who don't name the name of Jesus, they're your counterparts. And we challenge you to be Christian. And one of the ways that you get a chance to prove to the Lord and to others the authenticity of your Christian faith is how you engage with peacemaking. It says, blessed are the peacemaker, for they should be called what? The children of God. And so that's a key foundation that's really lost in the time of this toxic polarization. The second one is to increase the cultural intelligence. We can oftentimes talk past one another, use the same words but have very different meanings, then debate over those words. But we say, like, hey, no, let's increase the cultural intelligence. You know, it seemed like y'all have traveled before. You've been on a missions trip and somebody can't get their order right. And what they start doing in this country that speaks a different language, they start speaking louder and slower in English. Mm-hmm. That's not exercising cultural intelligence. You know, well, we oftentimes do that culturally when we go from one part of town to another part of town, one racial ethnic group, one socioeconomic group, one education level to another education level. The third thing is we can dismiss one another's experiences when we have cognitive dissonance. But one of the things that's really a great gift as a Christian is that we know that Jesus, like God didn't try to transform from a distance. God came in the form of humanity and exercised empathy to get a chance to understand our experiences. So we don't have to agree with the other person's experience in order to have empathy for their experience. And empathy goes a long way. So developing those skills within the community. The fourth deal is these three skills help you to be able to be a better cross-cultural collaborator. We try to jump in to fix problems, but not actually do the formation, the skill sets that we need. And so as we do the cross-cultural collaboration, and actually we don't do it just so we can have better conversations. We do this so that we get into reconciling culture making. We're here today because of the culture that was made yesterday. If we want to see something different tomorrow, we have to create new culture today. Mm-hmm. And this is what's exciting about things. Because in our institutions, like, you know, a lot of times when people talk about race, they talk about personal, interpersonal. Or they might jump to systemic. Now, here's the thing. It takes a long time to change hearts. It takes a long time to change policies. But we all form institutions, and our institutions form people, and people form institutions. And so what we have a lot more influence in our institutions to say, is your Christian institution a reconciling community? And you can cultivate that and put that into practice. And when the telos, the end aim of that, is to then say, hey, can we create some structures of innovation to reimagine and create the kind of world that we want to see. And every one of us has a part to play in that role. So that's what we do at Erebon, is to try to help Christian institutions to be a reconciling community from a spiritual formation start and through line that helps you to move towards structures of innovation for your particular local context.
Thanks so much, David.
Thanks.
Awesome. And Vivian Long is the leader of her family foundation, which invests in Asian American civic and ministry leaders. So, and she's a gathering participant. So,
I am.
Thanks, Vivian, for telling us about your work.
Thank you. Well, Chuck and David, I can't follow that, so
right.
I'm not even going to try. But I think from where I sit, it's in a little bit of a different role. So, as Michelle said, I serve as the executive director of the Long Family Foundation, and so I have the privilege to serve my family, and I have the privilege to serve our nonprofit partners. And we have five areas of focus right now, and one of those areas is Asian American Pacific Islander community building. So I started in this role about 5 years ago, and I inherited some what we call legacy grants from my parents, and they had been doing some grant making, particularly in the Chinese American space. So we're Chinese by heritage, and a lot of it was looking at the history of Chinese Americans. So my great-grandfather worked on the railroads. My father immigrated here from China as a child. And so I think for them, retaining that history was really important. And at that time, I was in my late 20s, and I don't think I had really processed my own experience as an Asian American, but because of the work they had been doing, I had been kind of invited into the space of Asian American community building. And the first thing I realized was that I had no idea what I was doing, despite being Asian American myself. I had no real understanding of the nonprofit landscape, and I think one of the most important things was that I just needed to remember that even though I was Asian American myself, and I remind myself this every day, I don't speak on behalf of all Asian Americans. Mm-hmm. My experience is very singular. And in fact, I think as I've been processing this, it's also acknowledging the privilege that I sit in as a woman, as a person of color, but also someone who has resources, who's been able to be educated. And so I think it was really with that understanding that the question for our family was, what is the commitment we are going to make to the Asian American community through the foundation and for ourselves as well? And the past few years have been a real journey. This was prior to this rise of coverage and anti-Asian hate that happened this spring. But now that I look back on it, I can see a lot of latent forms of anti-Asian rhetoric and the way that Asian women have been sexualized. I talked to all of my Asian girlfriends as this was happening, especially after the Atlanta SWA shootings. Every single one of us have been sexualized in a way that correlated directly to the fact that we were Asian. And so I think one of the things when I think about reconciling communities is acknowledging how we have been part of the problem. I think Asian Americans have distanced themselves as a community of color, and I think in a lot of ways we've been used to distance ourselves from other communities of color. I talk a lot about the model minority myth. What does that mean? And even the language model minority, how problematic is that to say one minority is a model, implying that the others are not? And so unpacking a lot of that, just in the way that we think about each other as communities of color, that has been a big part of our journey. And you know, I think especially in the rise of things that have happened, injustices against the Black community and more recently the Asian community, it feels personal. It feels personal in a really deep way. And one of the verses that I've really been reflecting on is James 1:19, quick to listen, slow to anger. Mm. And I think when it comes to issues of race, we are really quick to anger. Mm-hmm. And it's because it feels so visceral. It feels like you have to protect yourself. I mean, I'm a 5-foot Asian woman, and after this happened, I was like, what would I do if I was in the grocery store, something happened? I was attacked, somebody tried to approach me, and you feel like all you can do is try to defend yourself. But God calls us to a different model, and that is to be quick to listen, slow to anger. And so I think for us, as we think about our philanthropy, part of it is saying, okay, we need to also be quick to listen to the people who know more than we do. And for us, that's all of our Asian American nonprofit leaders. They are the ones on the ground, they are the ones doing the work, and we need to be informed by them and not informed by what we honestly may be feeling or what we may be experiencing. And so for us, one of the forms that we've been doing that is by investing in research. And one of the reasons AAPI research is so important is because there is so much disparity within the AAPI community. So one of the really great reports that I like to reference came out earlier this year, and it's
what's
about
AAPI?
Oh, I'm sorry, Asian American Pacific Islander. And one of the studies that came out was about the wage gap for women. And so it found that Chinese American women and Indian American women actually were paid very close to what white men were paid. But when you looked at other Asian American ethnicities, Filipino women are paid 83 cents on the dollar to what white men are paid, Vietnamese women 63 cents, Cambodian women 60 cents, and Burmese women 49 cents. And so you think about, actually, in this study it shows Indian American women are paid more than white men, but you think about also these Burmese women who are paid less than half. Other reports that look more at Asian Americans in comparison with other communities of color in Orange County, which is just about an hour away from here, Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders. So we're all considered under the same umbrella, although it's a very, very different profile. Only 19% of them obtain a college degree compared to 38% of the population in Orange County. And that's those Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander dropout rates in Orange County are identical to that of the Black and Latino community. And so when you think about this challenge, this opportunity, and how you activate yourself, I think it's really important to understand the full context and to really ask yourself, what is the commitment that I'm willing to make when it comes to building an undivided and reconciling community in my own, you know, sphere of influence? And part of that, I think, is doing the work to really understand the full breadth of disparity that exists.
Yeah, thanks so much, Vivian. So grateful for all that you guys have shared. Well, I'm sure you all have lots of questions. So we don't have a mic to go around. So if you would just stand up and ask it loudly, I'll repeat it. So I would love to just have anyone who has a question. Yes. David, repeat the three technical approaches.
So the first foundation, imagine this being like a house. The foundation is reconciliation and spiritual formation, just that commitment. Then in practice, the first pillar would be increasing your cultural intelligence. The second pillar is understanding diverse shared narratives. That's like engaging empathy. The third pillar is practice cross-cultural engagement. And then imagine like the roof is going to be engaging in reconciling culture making.
Yes.
In approaching the subject of racism, of course, during the pandemic, because of Black Lives Matter, it was focused on the Black community. But as we hear, you know, it's a much broader problem. In Miami, we've got the Latin community too, and we've got lots of different communities. So my question is, what's the best way to go about this reconciliation?
Yeah, it's a great question. Let me just repeat it. So our friend here is from Miami, and in Miami, there's, of course, lots of different races. And so her question is, how do we go about having this conversation when it's not just one race, when we're looking at multiple races, particularly in such a diverse community as Miami? Whoever would like to
I'll start and say, I think, you know, if we take it just from a kingdom perspective, the kingdom perspective for me is always, how can you be as inclusive as possible? In your approach. I do think that one of the things that is helpful to do is to understand where the biggest gaps are. So I love your idea around research, because what you may find in Miami is gonna be very different than what you would find in a, you know, Rust Belt Midwest city, right? And so I think that it's important to understand that, and then to look for ways that you can do things that, you know, to the degree that it can lift all the boats, that's a great thing. But I do find that there's going to be a need for some specialization. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I always use the example of, like, if you were to go to a mission country somewhere else, if you're going on a mission, you would exegete the culture. You would want to understand the culture. And that would inform the way that you would go before them with the gospel. And I think the same is true in this, that how do you exegete your culture, your context, your region, your city, and then make decisions around strategy based on that.
Amen to what Chuck shared. And the exegete, just of Chuck and I are pastors, and so, like, we use nerdy words a lot. It just means, like, how do you read your culture, right? And interpret your culture. I would also say, too, I think as you think about this, I think the way to think about this, like, let's take a missionary approach. There's some general practices that you have when you cross from one culture to the next that people will prepare for you. Say we're like the International Mission Board, and these folks are going to China, these folks are going to India, these folks are going to Nigeria. There's some general things that we would cross-culture and understand. But you need to understand, if you're in China, that you're dealing with, like, a place that just has not had existence of God in the communist context. If you're in India, you got to know that you're dealing with a culture that's been shaped by a caste system. If you're in Nigeria, you got to know that you're dealing with a context that deals with tribalism. And every society has division and ways of organizing the society around division. In America, race is the way that we have been ordered. It's just, you know, and that's just, if we can just understand that, that's our social context. And so the more that you can kind of understand how did that happen, it's helpful. Mm-hmm. So, you know, part of what you can, like, where did whiteness and blackness come from? You can thank Richmond, Virginia for that. We, you know, in 1790, they created a law when you had poor indentured European servants with Africans. They were together. They were all poor together, same deal. You had a few rich landowning men. They tried to have a revolt. It was unsuccessful. And then they implemented the golden rule. He that has a goal makes the rules. So they created this rule that said, hey, if you are white, if you have white skin, it's illegal. You cannot be a slave. You can be a Christian servant, but you can't be an enslaved person. If you are an African, if you have black skin, not even African, if you have black skin, then you are automatically a slave. That's the moment where white skin got privileged legally. And so then that created an opportunity for white people to be able to, like, participate in the land ownership and all that kind of stuff, and then for black folks to have to prove that they belong. So then, that's before we're a country. And so then, when you deal with the, I'm sorry, I didn't know 1790, I can't remember, 1710. So then, when you deal with 1776, you become a country. Then in 1790, when you do your first immigration policy, who can become a citizen, who can't? This is where Asian brothers and sisters come in. Because they said, hey, you have to be, the law was you have to be a white male that was free for 2 years, and then you can become a naturalized citizen. So the first group of Asian people, well, non-white immigrants to come in were Chinese people, and then sometimes they're categorized as white, sometimes they're categorized as black. It just depends on what type of agenda was going on politically, and then you had Japanese and Korean and so on, and there's this pitting against one another where you either have to either be white or to be black. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to be, like, economically and legally, you don't want to be black. Sports and entertainment, that's a whole other subject. But, like, you know, but so this created this continuum of this pitting against one another. And then you literally can go and read, like, the newspaper from 150 years ago, what folks are saying about Mexican and Muslim brothers and sisters today is what they were saying about Chinese and Sikhs 150 years ago. Mm-hmm. Same exact story, different people, groups. And so as you understand that greater narrative, it helps you to understand how to exegete, how to interpret Miami, Cincinnati, Richmond, Tyler, Texas, Chicago, wherever you are. And this is the thing that's great about this. One of the works of the Holy Spirit is that we see it manifest in Acts 2, that when God brings people together and we're open for the interpretation of tongues, that means being able to hear one another for the glory of God, that you see that nobody had any lack for anything, that generosity was a work of the Spirit, that they were in a context where they could never depend on the government for any kind of help. And yet they were all taking care of one another in the house of God. And so that's the type of invitation that you want to receive as you understand more about your context.
Yeah.
Yes. Thanks. Yes, to all of that. I would also add the exercise of considering the power dynamics that exist is something that I think is really important when you talk about race. And I think our foundation's philosophy is that it's the onus of the person who has the power to consider what that power dynamic looks like and how to balance it, right? I mean, by definition, the people who are not in power are usually not able to voice the way that they feel like they're made to be inferior or made to feel like they have less ownership. And so I think for those of us that do sit in positions of privilege, of power, and that could even be leadership, right? How do you consider the implications of your institution and the way that you're structured and how that might create that power imbalance. And I think when you do that in the context of race, you'll probably see a lot of ways in which non-intentionally that power imbalance exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. Another question, yes. Yeah, the question is, can you talk more about what happened when you went to talk to the chief of police and how that played out with other races?
Yeah.
Yes, oh, sorry. Okay, I'll say it even louder. Oh, yeah, because that's moving, sorry. Yeah, so the question is asking Chuck if he can talk about his conversation with the chief of police and how it played out with other races.
Yeah, so I think this is, let me go back to what David said and give you a little bit of interpretation of Cincinnati. So Cincinnati is probably, the city proper is 50% African American, probably 40% white. And even in the suburbs, there's very little representation of other races and ethnicities. There's some, but it's not a significant population. So we're talking about a community where the disproportionate number of people were either going to be black or white. And so in terms of the police chief and the police force, it was really interesting because, you know, in some ways, this is a suburb of the city. We're not talking about like the urban core of Cincinnati. And yet it's one of the suburbs where a lot of times African-Americans who are middle class or maybe even upper class are moving. So you see this transition of where populations go. So this is a police force that had, I believe, a very forward-thinking police chief. And he really was thinking through the school district, which is already starting to look, and this is how it plays out. The school district is a place where you start to see the breadth of the diversity coming into a community, because no matter what race or background you are, if you have kids, you put your kids in school for the most part, right? And so I think that was some of the power, the powerful choices that he made to say, hey, this is what's happening in Miami Township, and so how can we be ahead of the curve? I should say, when we do our experience in churches, obviously there's a faith dynamic to it. You know, there's preaching every week, not preaching every week, there's teaching every week that people experience. Believe it or not, the police chief didn't want us to come and preach to his people, so we didn't do that. But all the other experiences were the same. And I think for me, it was just a really eye-opening thing to see that, you know, gospel principles are gospel principles. Yeah. And so when you set up an environment around gospel principles, that happens, like the spirit is there. And I'll tell one quick story about this that I love to talk about is, you know, certainly there were change of hearts of policemen that were in that, and they were very helpful and thankful for that experience. But I always think about an African-American woman, she's 60 years old, spitfire, her name was Tammy. And so the last week of our class, we have people say, hey, what are you gonna start doing, what are you gonna stop doing? And like I said, Tammy was a spitfire, so Tammy had no problem saying to the police on the call, she said, well, I'm gonna tell you, I got on this so that you white police officers can get your act together. That's why I did these 6 weeks. But she said, but I recognize going through this, that I am giving you a bias that I don't want you to give toward me. And my heart's been changed.
Wow.
And I want to go a different direction in terms of how I give you the benefit of the doubt, because I know what that feels like now. Mm-hmm. And again, I look at that and say, that's what happens when we get in proximity and when there's empathy and sharing of stories, you have an opportunity to see a transformation that I don't think we can get to if we don't get close to each other.
Amen. That is so true. And for me, just having multiracial friendships with people from different colors, has different races, different ethnicities, has completely enriched my life and improved me as a person. So some more questions. Yes. Okay, I'm going to summarize. So, I mean, I know these guys heard it, but I want everyone to be able to hear it. So it was basically, how do we as the Big C Church kind of move forward, really looking at when Sunday morning is still the most segregated time? How do we move forward as the Big C Church toward healing? who would like to jump in on that?
The pastors.
I mean, I would start with a couple of things. Diversity doesn't guarantee reconciliation. Diversity guarantees conflict. So
I think you should say, I quote that all the time from David because it is such a powerful insight. Say that one more time.
Diversity doesn't guarantee reconciliation. Diversity guarantees conflict. And so what you want to, the goal shouldn't be diversity. The goal should be being a reconciling community. It's about the practice in which you're engaging in, and prayerfully, diversity becomes the fruit. And so that's the kind of the telos and goal that we want to do. Now, I think, I'm not saying diversity doesn't matter because it helps to shape in a lot of different ways, but we got to understand like how hard it is to engage in diversity in America. So like, you even think about when Jesus was confronted with that question about what does it mean to be a neighbor? And you know, he tells the story about the Jericho Road and how the priest, the pastor walked by. It wasn't your pastor, but it was another pastor down the street. You know, the Levite walked down, you know, walked by, and it was a Samaritan. And that was the scandal of the story. But here's the thing. It was about everybody knew that the Jericho Road was that part of town where bad stuff happens. Well, the way America has been ordered, our roads, if you have enough money, relationships, and education, you don't ever have to go by the Jericho Road until you go on a missions trip. And so this is something that is like very, very significant for all of us to understand. You know, being rich and poor is relative, right? But like, if we are in this space having this conversation, we all have a lot of control over our lives. Mm-hmm. And so we are so distant from Jericho Road situations that it's incumbent upon us to put ourselves in positions to get close to the proximity to the problem, because that's really key for our formation. Mm-hmm. Jesus says, like, this is what it means to love your neighbor. So one of the things that you just got to realize, that's not easy for us. Like, if you are an educated, wealthy, or relationally connected American Christian, it is difficult for us to do the thing that Jesus said is so important for us to do, and that's to love our neighbor as ourselves. So we got to realize some of the obstacles in that space, and then let's say, hey, what are some of the practices that we can engage in to do this? So coming back to the 11 o'clock being the most segregated hour, I think there are things that we can think through. You know, our zip codes, one of the biggest injustices going on in America is that zip codes can determine your health outcomes, the challenges that you face, the difficulties you have. If you don't believe that, then just move your kids to the zip code with the poor schools, you know, and just see how that turns out. Mm-hmm. You know, we actually choose to live places in ways, and the folks that don't have choices, they just gotta figure it out, right? And so our churches reflect that too. We tend to be a reflection of our society, economically, racially, ethnically, and these things are so intertwined. So the more that we can kind of understand the complexities of the situation, and it's the other thing we have to understand, is that racism, not oppression, not human hierarchy is unique to America and unique to Christianity. Racism specifically is unique to, that's a uniquely Christian problem. It wasn't Islamic theology that justified this. It wasn't Hindu theology that justified this. It was Christian theology that was co-opted to justify a lot of this work. So we gotta reckon with our ancestors and the things that have happened. We gotta understand it. We gotta understand the way our society has been socially ordered. And this gives us an opportunity to, here's some secret weapons that we have as Christians. We got people who don't follow Jesus who understand all those things I just shared as a statement of fact. So then they use work-based righteousness to accomplish these things. Yep. What we have in the book of Psalms are like 40% of our Psalms are lament. Mm-hmm. So part of the situation is that you first gotta like own it. There's a lot of things to grieve about, to confess to the Lord that this is just really messed up, and just bring that anger to the Lord. The Lord's not fragile. He wants to see that, bring those tears to the Lord. But God will meet you in that. And then the second thing is we have the gift of confession, and the gift of repentance with the Holy Spirit. Mm. That, like, we got the answers but don't know the problems. The people that understand the problems don't have the answers. And so that's the thing where I think if we could kind of engage in that practice, that's a really, really, really key element to kind of help with the more segregated hour.
Yeah. I would say one thing I've even just been reflecting on in this conversation is, you know, when there have things been said to me about my race, like, you're taught, especially as an Asian American, I think, to kind of, like, quell it, right? Like, oh, they probably didn't mean it in a racist way. Mm-hmm. Because it's not always as overt as, yeah, I think, what other communities of color experience. But I think what you guys are saying is, like, racism is not always intentional. And that's not a good thing. But reconciliation has to be intentional. Mm-hmm. Nobody, like, accidentally, like, decides, like, oh, I guess, like, I'm part of a reconciled community now. Like, the process of that is long. It is hard. It is takes work. It takes self-reflection. It takes confession, right? And, like, that is a process that you have to intentionally choose to go on. But saying a racist remark because it was something that you may not have even really meant, but that's a seed that has been planted in your head for a long time, like, that's easy. And so I think, like, that process, like, we have to remember, like, how easy it is to slip into that and how hard the process of reconciliation is. But that is what we're called to do as Christians. So I think it's, like, that dichotomy of, you know, you want to kind of solve the problem quickly, but, like, it's unpacking all of this generational trauma, your own learnings, your own upbringing, and it's just this continual journey.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you guys so much. I mean, it's so true. It's such an individual and a personal journey. And unfortunately, we're out of time, so we can't take any more questions, but I just encourage you all to come up and talk to these amazing panelists, get to know them, and ask.